Dr. Nader, I've got a quick question. If you would just expand a little bit, you know, you talked a little bit about, you know, if we have a gene that maybe only affects a trait 8%, is it really fair or feasible to incorporate that in a genetic evaluation?
Well, there's two issues, and it's important, I think, we keep them separate. We judge the importance of a marker based on the marker effect. If the magnitude of the difference is large enough to be useful and informative, we should consider incorporating that marker, because the nice thing about the marker is, in theory, it is a true indicator of genetic merit. I talked about the heritability associated with the marker, and I want to focus that not on whether the marker is worth using. You judge that based on the marker effect. Use the heritability associated with the marker to highlight how important the rest is. Okay? So you've got two different issues. And I think we can say with the GeneStar modeling marker, the effect is modest, but the effect on percent choice, because of the place where the thresholds and breakpoints lie, are such that that marker has had some impact in the industry, even if it only accounts for 10% of the total variation. So I think it's a separate issue. If the marker effect is adequate to have an impact on the value of the animal, then that marker is a candidate for incorporation. But if that marker has only a 10% effect, then we certainly don't want to tie our whole breeding program to that marker. We can't do that. And I'd defer also if Dick or others want to make comments on that same thing. You've heard me. You need to hear the rest of this panel.
The thought crossed my mind, is it possible that these markers could be having more effect than we think, because what we're doing is we've got a subjective measurement in what we call choice. So this, in other words, there may be, say if there's 100 specks of marbling in a 12-inch ribeye, and there's 100 specks of marbling in a 15-inch ribeye, invariably, the 15-inch ribeye with the same amount of marbling is going to grade less than choice, possibly. So it may be that the subjectivity compared to the objectivity is not meeting. Now, this is a cowboy talking, remember that.
No, I mean, you're right. We know that, especially for traits involving quality, tenderness, marbling, we got to go from genetics, to biology, to phenotypes and economic value. And we need to understand the biology, and then we can flow through different breeds with different average marbling, selling cattle in different markets. You're exactly right. A marker, we need to know what its physiological effect is, because that's what's going to ripple through the whole production system in terms of animal performance. And then we also need to know what it does to our bottom line. You know, if you're in a breed that is way below some threshold, let's say for prime, well, increasing marbling score by a third of a grade isn't going to provide much for you. But it may do something to the biology of the animal. No, your point's well taken. We just have to know the whole story.
Dave, I'd like you to comment on, as a strategy, you were talking about strategies. Imagine a couple scenarios. One scenario would be to find the bulls that are homozygous for the, quote, best markers. Another scenario, and look at their estimated breeding values or their EPDs. Now, another scenario is that you have two kinds of bulls. One, they have equal EPDs. One of them is homozygous for the best markers, the other is not. What do you do? What's the strategy to maintain the maximum opportunity in this population to... I think it actually affects some of the equations and the algebra you were showing, but it seems to me it might be a mistake to only use the homozygous markers, that you'd narrow your genetic variation.
Just
what you said, and that what you really want to do is introduce that gene into those families that also have the equal EPDs.
Absolutely. I mean, the comment that Mark...
I'm not sure I'm asking a question. I'm just sorry, but you could comment on that.
Well, I would like to comment on it because it's important. And I mean, Mark made the comment last night. If you have two individuals that one of which does not carry the marker but is a proven sire with a high EPD, that's the bull you want to use, because the EPD of a proven sire is still, by and large, the definitive indicator. The other thing is, and we've seen it with these marbling markers, if I have an individual with an exceptionally high EPD or with an EPD equal to a bull that carries the marker, then that's a source of other genes that I must use. It's far easier to stick the marker into a family that doesn't possess it than it is to take an individual with a known marker genotype and manipulate all the other genes. So we've got to remember, by my math, 90% of the opportunity for improvement is outside that marker. And I can move that marker into those exceptional families that don't possess it and, in theory, have the best of both worlds. We can't forget those other genes. Oh, Dick, would you like to comment on that?
I guess I don't disagree with anything Dave said. One point that does need to be made is all the figures we see on these markers are looking at the genotype of the animal measured, and most of these have been carcass traits, so they're genotypes of slaughter cattle. Nobody cares about their EPD or breeding value, because they sure aren't going to leave any progeny. What we're really interested in is the genotype of sires. And the genotype is going from the sire to the progeny, like an EPD, the magnitude of the effect is essentially cut in half. Because we don't transmit genotypes, we just transmit one gamete. So we're just getting one of those markers in his genotype into those progeny. So the magnitudes of the effects are not as big. Now, firstly, this business of getting overly concerned about everybody's going to want a 2-star or a 3-star or whatever. Well, we're going to have enough of these that you aren't going to find a 10-star bull. And so there's going to be maybe a short period of time when people will overemphasize the markers, the individual markers, just saying, want to put 2 stars or 4 stars or a 5 or a 1 or whatever, however the different genotyping companies score these things. But as soon as we've got 6 or 8 markers up there, it's going to be pretty hard for the whole industry to focus on just two bulls.
I have a question for all of the panels, I guess. Dave, you didn't mention anything about the interaction between alleles at different markers and how that fits into the validation process. I didn't hear it if you did. And then, Dick, given the frequency of the alleles that we're seeing in the validation process, if we took on the responsibility of looking for those interactions, how big do those populations have to get? And then the two guys sitting there, are you guys working on building these populations currently?
Well, to address the interactions, John, we just don't know to what extent markers will be additive. We have to think that by the time we get 4 or 5 or 6 or 7, they won't be simply additive. I do like, and there's a piece in the written paper I didn't get to. Some of you know that you know, late at night when no one's around, I sometimes work with sheep EPDs. And in New Zealand, they have identified 3 separate markers for ovulation rate in sheep populations. And they have now produced an animal that carries 1 copy of each of these 3 separate markers. As a 2-year-old, she had an ovulation rate of 12. Pretty additive. She only had triplets, though, and she actually had babies. Not so additive. We've just got to look. That's got to be part of the validation process, and it must be part of the validation process.
Well, I'll let you deal with the numbers.
This was on the frequency.
I think
I was supposed to say how many do we need to get the frequencies by breed? I'm a curmudgeon. I don't have a good memory.
I personally love that description, too. Because I office next to him. Now, I was asking, given the problems we've had with validation and the frequencies of these genotypes in populations where we've tried validations at this point, we start adding the interaction of genotypes at different markers. How big are these populations going to have to be?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah,
because Dave's nice 50-50 is the exception, not the rule. And a lot of times the favorable allele, you know, not looked at a lot of genes, 3 or 4, is down around 10 to 15%. And so now, and you're right. So we need a fair number, and that really messes it up, because when I look at the total number of genotypes, and the one I'm done the most work with is Galpain. There's 2 SNPs, so there's 9 possible genotypes. And in the bulls I've looked at, the Simmental bulls, there's whole classes of genotypes completely missing, because one allele at one SNP has a very low frequency. So if you take and multiply that times the low frequency at another one, depending on if they happen to work in the worst case, we are going to need huge numbers of animals, thousands. To see, so we get a good representation of all the genotypes. I've never actually looked to see if I put what few markers I have on these cattle together to see just what is the distribution across GeneStar marbling, the gender gene, the leptin, and so forth.
Responding to your question about, you know, our breed associations working on populations for validation, the answer is yes. And actually, the process started, you know, as many of you know, back in 1998 when most of the breed associations in here were part of the NCBA Carcass Merit Project. A lot of us, continue to collect data and DNA samples. I think we need direction, though, as to what those populations look like, how big they need to be. And, it's really, I don't want to say it's easy, but it is collectible to collect, those traits that we currently collect, weaning weight, birth weight, marbling score, those types of traits. You know, we can collect that data in pretty large numbers and have been collecting that data. But on families, identifying the sires and getting enough progeny out of those sires, it is difficult. That's not easy data to collect, even though we collect a lot of it. It's going to become more difficult to collect and build populations for traits that we don't collect information on very much. I'm talking about reproductive traits and disease and several other traits that may become important just in terms of markers. So it's going to be more difficult, I think, to collect that type of information and build those types of populations.
Dr. Pollack, I'd like to just ditto what Robert just said. We're still in a real business development mode with regard to this technology, and I'll just be frank with you and share what goes on in our daily lives in the association world. I say this humbly, but association staffers and execs are really the gatekeeper to the commercialization and implementation of new technologies. And we've been there for eons, back when the pedigrees and the books even began. That's not always a pleasant position to be in, particularly when you're incorporating new technology. And it is frustrating when companies, and I understand venture capital requires return on investment, but it is frustrating when technology is moved out into the industry ahead of the bell curve and the business applications are not properly addressed. And we have an opportunity right now on the front end and the ground floor of this business to begin to address those business applications. And I want to present to you two scenarios, two very business-like scenarios. One is unrelated to the beef industry, and one is related to the beef industry, where business application was planned for and business application was not. On Friday of last week, there were a group of Kansas Herford breeders that hosted a barbecue for 300 troops at Fort Riley, Kansas, that just came back from Iraq. and we had an opportunity to visit with them, and each and every one of them were very businesslike. And it seems when life and death are on the line, you get real businesslike. And we had an opportunity to talk about what's really happening in Iraq and what really went on with Operation Iraqi Freedom. And whether through folklore or what have you, there was a really dynamite story that came down through the ranks that discussed the planning of Operation Iraqi Freedom. And General Frank, and y'all all remember General Frank and what a taskmaster he was, had each and every one of his commanding officers from each division of the military present a strategy on how they were going to attack Iraq. And a young colonel from the War College presented the Air Force strategy. And in that strategy, he was extremely excited, motivated, and dedicated. And he was going to bomb every bridge in Iraq. He was going to bomb every power plant. He was going to knock out all communications. It was going to be over in about 48 hours. General Frank, being the taskmaster, said, "Blankety, blank, 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 Colonel, what are you thinking?" And you guys can fill in the blanks. "Have you ever heard of nation building? I've got to get across those bridges, and when I get to Baghdad, I'm going to have to go back and rebuild them. And if I have to go back and rebuild them, that's coming out of the Air Force budget." So he took a different approach. And being a combat veteran, he understood what the capabilities of the Iraqi military was and the U.S. military. Consequently, there was one bridge knocked out in the whole country, and that was because there were military targets surrounding that bridge. And that came from several of those young men that came back from Iraq. They took a business approach. Let's talk about ultrasound technology for a minute. And I had a great conversation with John Crouch this morning, who's been very instrumental in organizing the technology of ultrasound and standardizing it. Ultrasound technology is an old technology. American Herford Association began ultrasound in cattle in the 70s. And it wasn't until 1995 or 96, and I believe 98 for Angus, in the mid to late 90s, where the technology was actually taken into an EPD, into a genetic evaluation. All the data prior to that was not standardized and was subsequently thrown out. And so all of the effort going into that technology was basically for none. It was a good exercise in research, but it didn't really move our populations. So we can today either take a business approach and get on the same bandwagon and address many of these issues, such as what traits do we want to begin to look for so we can build the populations. Establish the procedures for DNA collection. Develop the policies to prevent selective reporting. Collect DNA material and educate our breeders properly on its proper use. Let's get it into cattle evaluation. And if I had a challenge today, it would be, let's open up our doors to our respective organizations and our respective corporations and get in the same room and begin to develop these plans. And I think BIF is certainly the place to do that.
I like what you just said, Craig. That's excellent, and that's what we need to do. I have a question, kind of back to the original subject of multi-trait selection in single-gene society. For 6 years, we had a whole herd reporting committee, and we sunsetted that last year. It was the last year of that. And, you know, one of the things, a lot of that has gone largely unimplemented, where we're getting reproductive data on inventory-based cow systems. We're getting full reporting on weaning weights. And what are the implications if we start going after one or two genes on a carcass trait if we do not implement the earlier stuff that has a broader base of importance?
Repeat that one more time.
We've talked, we had a BIF committee on whole herd reporting, and we talked about that for 6 years. And largely, the breed associations that has been unimplemented, where we collect whole inventory reproductive data. and get all the weaning weight reporting, all production reporting. And now if we move into markers without the broad-based reproductive data, what are the implications of that? Seems to me we're kind of skipping over one technology to the next, and I'm a little scared of skipping the middle technology or system.
Well, I think you're right, exactly right, and we started building these databases, more complete reporting of data, more reproductive data, and a lot of us are still in the process of building those databases, and we're in the process of going through the validation process, we might say, in terms of getting our genetic parameters in place and so forth, to build genetic values for those traits. It takes time. But we don't want to go backwards and forget about the progress that we've made in multi-trait selection. We'll hear here at this conference yet this week about some of the multi-trait selection indexes that some of the breeds have put into place already, and how those are going to progress over the next several years, and how they should progress, and rightfully so. I guess, someone mentioned earlier about there's going to be a lot of markers out there, so you're not really going to be able to concentrate on one. And I guess I can kind of relate that back to the development of ultrasound, maybe, before we were able to incorporate ultrasound data into a genetic evaluation. But a lot of producers out there, would print in their catalogs and IMF score and on different various technologies and from various people that collected that data, technicians. But I don't see that ultrasound would have really changed much. That we were collected only on a few animals, so we really wouldn't have had a good feel about how to implement that into selection schemes across the breeds until we were able to incorporate that information into the genetic evaluation. That data now is going into our genetic evaluation for Charlet. This is fall, actually, ultrasound data. We'll go into our genetic evaluation for carcass merit, which will then be included in our multi-trait selection index in terms of those carcass CPDs. So I think that's a step, same kind of process we're going to go through with these markers is that it's going to have to go through this growth period of understanding what those markers are telling us and how we incorporate those into our genetic evaluation before we can really make full use of those. But the problem is not getting distracted from that process in the meantime, that we overemphasize, these handful of markers that we've got and not, properly use the tools that we do have. Yes. Yeah, right.
I think his question stimulates another question on my part that's related, but would it be possible for, if there is market data on individual animals, that the breed association be the keeper and aware of that information, that they're part of the information base? And then would it be possible for all the phenotypes that you have in your database to estimate the regression of performance on traits X, Y, Z on marker phenotypes? And wouldn't that be a useful tool and a way to and publish those somewhat like we now publish other information in our SAR evaluations or somewhere on our web pages?
Well, that's probably, Dr. Candace, the first phase of the business plan is collection of the phenotypes. Well, and ahead of that, identifying what phenotypes you want to collect. Bob, back to the job that you folks have done over the years with whole herd reporting, that is being implemented, albeit gradual. There's organizations, associations, and breed groups that are collecting that information in large scale. And I think, again, that's part of the initial phase. And those are the phenotypes we're going to be really interested in because it's hard to get our arms around the value of that phenotype. And so, back to Dr. Kendall, are the associations willing to share those phenotypes in those populations? I would say yes. On the condition that we are partnered with corporations that are willing to pay for the test. We're not prepared to be an R&D arm and pay for the genotyping, and I think there's general consensus amongst breed associations that that is the relationship. We're the phenotype depository. We capture that. That's where we're investing our money and time. And they can help us by doing the genotyping, and we work together.
With the Holstein Association expressing fairly serious concern about effective population size and estimates from beef cattle populations, despite huge census numbers that suggest that effective population sizes for most beef cattle breeds are probably in the few hundreds or maybe smaller. What opportunities exist and what pitfalls exist for markers to either help resolve problems associated with effective population size and inbreeding, or lead us into the situation that Holstein's in now, where they're desperately searching for genetic variation?
You probably noticed Dick and I scrambling to get to the microphone to answer that question. I think the most of a couple different number of ways to come at this. One way to come at it is the rare marker. And if we rapidly and blindly embrace the rare marker, we are going to focus on potentially very small numbers of sires and do more damage to effective population size, whatever the implications are of that. So that's one piece of it that we have to be very careful about. We're seeing that with some of the scrapie resistance genes in sheep right now, and it's not reasonable. My personal opinion is that markers will do very little to help the situation with effective population sizes, because we see no evidence we've lost selection response or heritability even in the Holstein dairy cow for milk production. So I don't see us using markers as a diagnostic of genetic diversity. We may be able to when we see a problem, but I don't see that happening now. I don't see the markers, especially as we get more of them, there's no reason they should contribute to losses in genetic diversity. If we pay attention to some of the comments that Larry has made and that we've made from the podium, as long as they're a part of the system, as long as we recognize they're going to be very unlikely to account for more than 30% of additive variance, and maybe quite a bit less, we shouldn't have a problem if we approach this in a reasonable way. Okay?
I don't know, Dick, do you want to comment or not?
David, I really enjoyed your presentation. And I'm over here, David.
Oh, there he is.
I thought what you were saying about the incorporation of DNA test information was that you would make an adjustment to EPDs. Seemed like you had a slide that said something to that effect. And last night I thought Mark Tallman was saying something to the effect that that would be kind of a myth to just simply say, well, you can adjust the EPDs with information from DNA tests. Would you clarify that for me, please?
Yeah, I think the message that Mark and I were trying to convey is the same message, that we will use information from markers to adjust EPDs, but we will not simply add and subtract from an existing EPD. I mean, the data on a marker, and again, as Mark showed last night, if you have an animal that's evaluated with low accuracy based on performance, a marker can augment that, and if we do it right, can provide a better estimate of the EPD. It's not a simple mathematical addition. It's a process of incorporating the two properly. And frankly, I don't know how, I couldn't tell you today how to do that. There may be some people who can, but there aren't very many. And I think, Mark, would you agree that's a consistent approach? Yeah, I think that's the message. We can combine them, but we can't just add them.
I talked about this yesterday in the SIM seminar, and essentially I did incorporate the genotype of the sire when I computed it. And now it's the polygenic effect or the leftover effect of the sire given the genotype. And so it isn't the same as the previous EPD. And then when you adjust, when you calculate deviations essentially, and then it gets added back in. But if you look at the final EPD that comes out of the analysis compared to what happens if you ignore the genotype, you tend to see the ones that have the favorable, they tended to go in the, well, this was for shear force, so they tended to go down, and at least favorable went up. But it isn't a constant for every one of those bulls. It fluctuates very depending on pedigree, depending on numbers of progeny, and so forth. So you can't just take a current EPD and add something to it.
Nick Hammett, Bob Weber, thank you for helping us with the audience. One more question from me for the panel, and it's really about breed associations again, but it also relates to the scientists here. We found out how important it was to have a phenotypic database for shear force when all of a sudden calpain and calpostatin markers came around. So, Craig and Robert, we still, as long as we have semen stored on the legacy sires, I presume you all think that we're relatively safe to have DNA stored so that we can go through those sires forever and ever. So the sire side of this seems like it's pretty well sealed as long as we've got frozen semen on sires. But on females, influential females, not very, most of us don't have much of anything other than a little bit of DNA for parental validation. Is that right from your breeds? Thought that might be the case. Scientists, any suggestions? Is that good enough that we've got just a little bit of DNA on file relative to parental validation on females within the breeds? Because, David, you mentioned you thought maybe having female genotype would be important in genetic evaluation. Otherwise, we just simply don't have much DNA, I don't think, unless we've got some frozen embryos.
I think there are some ways, as I mentioned, to do efficient DNA storage on enough animals to validate. I'm not sure I'm too worried about having DNA on the most influential females, because if I can get DNA on the legacy-type sires two or three generations back, you know, I have a pretty good idea of genotypes on a pretty substantial number, especially if we use some of the technology Mark's developed to try and infer genotypes. I think more importantly is getting the DNA stored or in a form where it can be extracted to do some of the backward validations by being able to say, oh, here's a marker. Well, we have six sires that we know are heterozygous for that marker, and we can get DNA on 75 daughters from each sire. Haven't done it yet, but we have blood or hair or a way to do it. I'm not sure the DNA storage, well, we have to develop the designs we need, and we're not quite there yet. But I don't think the highly influential females really add that much to us.
Good, thank you. How about a nice round of applause for the panel? Wasn't that good?